is an attempt to show, first of all, that Marxist methodology is useful for women, and secondly, to show how it's useful for us in a Canadian context. That's what this is about. That's what this paper tries to do. The debate within the Canadian women's movement about the relevance of socialist theory continues. Is women's liberation possible without a socialist revolution? Can a socialist revolution occur without inevitable freeing women? What do we mean precisely by women's liberation? Are we content with the conception which promises personal fulfillment through self-exploration and knowledge? Does our liberation mean an end to the role stereotypes into which women and men are funneled? Does it mean an end to role stereotypes and to the exploitative nature of our society? Can a professional woman, a working class woman, a student, or a housewife be liberated as long as she has no control over the products of her labor? Can we be liberated through our very socialization into the stereotypes of passivity, acceptance, and non-aggressiveness? Is the fact that the women's movement started among students and relatively leisured women the critical factor in its development? It seems to me that those are very important questions, because the women's movement at this point in time is going in a myriad of directions. I'll talk more about that later on. Margaret Benston, in her paper, The Political Economy of Women's Liberation, and Mickey and John Rowntree, in their paper, More on the Political Economy of Women's Liberation, provide a valuable clue about a method for analyzing these conundrums. They deal with women's relationship to work in production. It is here that we begin to discern that male supremacy is an ideology which is extremely useful in the bolstering of our class society. Karl Marx, in Wage, Labor, and Capital, describes a commodity as containing both exchange value, that is, it can be exchanged for other commodities on the market through money, and use value, which is socially and historically defined. That is, prostitution has a use value in our society because marriage exists. Okay. Labor power, that is the capacity of human beings to create and work, is a commodity within capitalist society. That is, that's the commodity we sell. It is sold for wages, which are equivalent to the price paid for the worker's capacity to work. And it includes exchange value and use value. That is, labor power, the only commodity that given individuals have to sell, includes both exchange value and use value, those two concepts. Use value of labor power is realized when the worker produces wealth, which in capitalism is considered the private property of the employer. Labor power is sold to receive the necessary means of subsistence by the working class, a class which owns nothing but its own labor power. That is, there's a whole group of individuals or a class in our society which have nothing to sell except their labor power, their ability to create and work. Benston contends that women, as a group, are defined primarily as a group outside commodity production, outside the labor market. Women do not produce exchange value, but simple use values in those activities associated with the home and family. Women do not receive wages for their work within the home, although in sheer quantity, household labor, including child care, constitutes a huge amount of socially necessary production. That is, even though women do produce a large number of use values, Benston says that they're not part of commodity production in general in our society. These two statements illustrate the fact that the family provides a place for nurturing, taking care of physical and emotional needs on the basis of unpaid labor. Women are instead taught to expect payment for this labor through emotional fulfillment. So women get very hysterical at times when their expectations are disappointed in marriage. Of course, the bargain is seldom struck so cold-bloodedly. Instead, it's disguised in terms of eternal love and you'll get satisfied by having children and so forth. In a society where the most important person is the one who has accumulated the most capital, or failing that, draws the largest wage, we lose. Women have little real authority within the family. You've all heard the guy who says, I bring home the paycheck, I get to make the decision, which encourages the development of manipulative tactics for any power at all within the family by women. Romanticism in this way cloaks the real economic dependence of the woman. She must be in love with her husband and keep him in love with her, or lose the sole source of support for herself and her children. Basing one's permanent economic arrangements upon an emotional and sexual predilection does seem at best difficult and at worst insanity, but that's how the majority of us live. Women who don't choose marriage are punished in other ways. The impossibility of surviving with any independence or self if one submerges oneself in serving others, parents, children, a husband, etc., is explored thoroughly in literature like A Doll's House by Henry Gibson, a mere 100 years old. The woman in the bourgeois family was not always expected to be a doll wife, however. At the inception of the Industrial Revolution in England, the family was a productive unit. That is, it functioned as an economic unit. It produced enough goods for that unit to survive. Farmers' wives, according to Ivy Pinchbeck in Women Workers in the Industrial Revolution, often managed the dairies, the most lucrative part of the family's commodity production. Women in laboring families were expected to produce food from the small plots on the commons and supply clothing for the family. Landowners' wives sometimes participated in the management of the enterprise. Some of these upper-class women had a fairly powerful place in the community. There were, however, the facts of no control over reproduction, legal subservience to the male, and strain from huge workloads, which, along with the dominance of the male in the family, prevented any real equality. That is, we're not moving from a golden age into, a horrible situation. It's just that there were these mitigating factors working for women in that situation. The movement of craft production out of the home and its transformation into industrial production had two consequences for women. First, laboring women were compelled to support themselves by labor outside the home. So you see work going from being completely encapsulated within the household economy and moving outside. Women and children formed the large part of the industrial working class. Manufacturers in the first half of the 19th century pressed forward each innovation which enabled them to dispense with adult male craftsmen and to replace them with women or juvenile labor. So that you have a situation where William Blake, writing at the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution, can talk about the situation of children in poems like London, because he was a craftsman himself, an engraver, so they're in competition with him. So his class interest is hurt. Dr. Urey estimated from the reports of the factory inspectors in 1834 an adult labor force in all textile mills in the UK of 191,671, of whom 102,812 were women and only 88,859 were men. So the vast majority of people were women because they were categorized as lower paid workers even then. Women working had greater independence from their families as wage earners. That is, it had a second consequence besides being a lot of work. But the advantage was balanced against a high child mortality rate, long hours of work, and poor health. Women's participation in the labor force also speeded the process of women organizing politically. In 1818 and 1819, the first female reform societies were founded. Mickey and John Rowntree discuss women's participation in commodity production in contemporary American life in their paper. Okay, the point is, Benson says that women are defined as a group by being outside of commodity production because there's no commodity production which takes place in the home any longer. Mickey and John Rowntree go on to point out that women are in fact integral to commodity production and have been since the inception of the Industrial Revolution. That's the debate. The second consequence of industrial production was that women were freed from some of the onerous tasks involved with being primarily responsible for the home prior to Industrial Revolution. This was partly because the industrial production could substitute for home production, for instance, with clothing. It was no longer expedient for a woman to spend hours spinning when she could buy something much more cheaply that was industrially produced. It was also partly because girl mothers, who had perhaps worked in the mill from the age of 8 or 9, had no domestic training. Knowledge of the kind of work necessary to live even as adequately materially as before the Industrial Revolution was lost among large numbers of women in the working class. There was a mixture called Jeffrey's cordial, which was a mixture of laudanum and molasses, given to children to make sure that they did not cry and complain while their mothers were at work. There was no adequate way of taking care of them, so that was the consequence, keep them quiet. However, the consequence of industrializing much of the housework which was formerly done in single-unit production within the family has borne new fruit within the recent past. That is, we get to reap the benefits of the Industrial Revolution. More and more housework has been industrialized. Most work in the house now consists of further processing food, cleaning the house, taking care of the children. The possibility of completely industrializing and socializing these remaining tasks is before us. That possibility would involve communal kitchens, communal child care, new methods of cleaning, and besides paid labor to perform all these tasks. That is, it would no longer be considered as non-essential labor. However, within a capitalist society, when such work is already performed without wages, there is little impetus to develop new facilities. That is, if you can hire one worker, right, working in a plant for 3.60 an hour for the price of two workers, that is, someone who takes care of all his needs and functions, why would you bother paying for housework? It's just not economically rational, given that the motive. Given that the motive for production is profit. Another consequence of lessened labor in the house as a result of the development of technology is that many women feel non-productive in that environment. Some go to work, others resort to daytime television. Others, largely among middle-class women, have started doing handicrafts. Women's labor in the home takes a great deal of time but offers little satisfaction. Yet women are guilted because the still prevailing opinion is that it is only through this truly feminine work that women can be fulfilled. Devices which could be used to save time instead provide more complex methods of and more frequent occasions for cleaning and cooking. You must have all met the lady who spends hours and hours, like, or there's that commercial, isn't there, where the teacher's coming over and she's just shined the floor for the 12th time that week, something like that. Instead of just, you know, washing the floor once every however often a week, I don't know, and letting it go. You know, but instead it becomes an obsession, a daily task. We return to Benson's argument that women are primarily defined as a group outside of commodity production and that male supremacist ideology within capitalist society flows out of it. That is, that male chauvinism is possible, is a structure in our society because women don't produce useful labor that they get wages for. And that's the root of male chauvinism. While it is true that the prevailing mythology about women, which survives partly because of a conception of history that we generally hold, which is that women, that history is somehow seen as being the history of the class that's on top at the time. That is, in most histories of a given period, one doesn't consider, except recently, in social history, the class underneath. That is, one never sees Rome from the slave's perspective or the Industrial Revolution from the worker's perspective. And that is a habit of thought which also extends to women as an oppressed group. So the prevailing mythology about women is that we are outside of commodity production and should remain so. But however, I don't think that is a full picture of women's real position in this society. Mickey and John Rowntree, in their paper, point out that Benston does not deal adequately with the increasing absorption of women into commodity production. They show that in the U.S., women's participation in the labor force has increased since 1940. This increased participation of women in the workforce is also true for Canada. It's interesting, the area of life, the area of the workforce of labor, where there's been an actual increase in workers is in services, that is, in a woman's role, right? Indeed, this fact may be the material basis for the women's movement and for the changing consciousness of women generally. Women find an increasing contradiction between the mythology of the female, adored and cosseted as lover, wife, mother, and the real situation within the family as unpaid workers lacking anticipated emotional satisfaction. That is the saw between which is supposed to exist that in return for doing this unpaid work in the home, you get lots of emotional satisfaction, is becoming increasingly contradictory among many, many women. Finally, in commodity production, as the lowest paid, women find an increasing contradiction in commodity production as the lowest paid workers who also have to sell their sexual desirability. With the frustrations of the double workload, as general as they are now, we might expect that women in collective production would begin to reassess their position, particularly since there is a women's movement which began among students. Now I'm going to give some statistics which are from a pamphlet called Women in the Labor Force, 1970 Facts and Figures, put out by the Women's Bureau of the Canada Department of Labor. Sylva Gelbert did all this work. In 1970, the female labor force had increased 62.3% since 1960, that's over half again, to a total of 2,690,000, or almost 3 million women in the country who work in the labor force. That's a sizable percentage of labor force. Women in 1970 made up 32.1% of the total labor force as compared to 25.8% of the labor force in 1960. Okay, so the argument is that not only is it an adequate definition to define women in terms of their work within the family, that they are in fact, there is in fact increasing participation of women in the labor force, and that that's what's causing the redefinition of women's roles. Traditionally, the pattern has been to work until marriage, stop work, raise a family, then re-enter the labor market when the children are old enough. However, current statistics show an almost even age spread among women workers. Women are working now from the time they're out of secondary school until they're 60, pretty well across the board. They no longer quit and have a family. The number of married women in the workforce has risen from 11.6% in 1960 to 18.2% in 1970. In 1970, 32% of all married women worked. This indicates a critical difference in attitude among women, since married women have more options about joining the workforce than single, divorced, or widowed women. The statistics show that women have become a permanent part of the workforce outside the home, and the tendency to work outside the home can be found among women of all ages. They also show that more women are working outside the family than 10 years ago, so that the tendency is likely to increase given women's pressing economic reasons to work in the workforce. I mean, with an extractive industry, men's jobs are vanishing rapidly, so more and more women work. We must also assume that a major depression will not occur to deprive us of any possibility of work outside the family. So that then we move to what the women's movement does about this fact, right? Like, is it critical the fact that more and more women are working? What does it mean in terms of women in commodity production? What does that mean for the women's movement? And to try and figure it out, you have to consider where women work, what their wages are, and why wages are consistently lower than those of men. We must also consider the rooted problem of how to break down role divisions within the labor market, especially in terms of job typing through sexual stereotypes. People still laugh when a man says he's going to be a secretary, you know, and that's a very serious role stereotype which confines women to certain types of work to the exclusion of all else, and men too. Although I'd rather be confined to a job paying $15,000 a year than $5,000. It is in this study that we can see why it is so advantageous to capitalism to maintain a male supremacist ideology which encourages both women and men to consider women less capable in the real world and worth less in dollars, and yet as experts in emotional matters. Karl Marx discusses the extraction of surplus value in wages, price, and profit in terms of a capitalist buying the labor power of a given worker for a period of 12 hours a day, while the worker produces the amount of commodities equivalent to the goods necessary to sustain himself in 6 hours. The value which he produces in commodities during the rest of the time is surplus. Of course, some of it goes to pay for machinery, some for raw materials, and some for profit. That is, in Inco, for instance, a guy working at Inco 5 years ago reproduced his wages, the amount of money he got in wages, in something like 2.5 hours, which means out of an 8-hour day, not counting overtime, he's working at least 5.5 hours, right? And that wealth that he produces in that time goes directly back to Inco. So, and some of it does go for new plant, and some of it does go for raw materials, but the largest portion of it, in that case, goes for profit. Accordingly, we can conclude that the owner of the same means of production prefers to pay the lowest possible wages, as that ensures a higher rate of profit. During the Industrial Revolution, Marx defined that as being enough to support production, like to keep, to feed, clothe, and shelter you, and reproduction, to do the same for your children. But that wasn't even true for women. For instance, women didn't, during the Industrial Revolution, generally make enough money to support their children. That was why so much child labor was possible. Women hired by the state and state services received low wages too, which again saves money for capitalists who finance the state. That is, it is possible to classify a whole group of people as low-paid workers, which allows a higher rate of profit out of their collective labor, even though women generally work in labor-intensive jobs, than if they were paid wages comparable to that of men. That is, if all secretaries started getting paid, all secretaries, all service people started getting paid $500 a month, that would sizably reduce the rate of profit in any given industry or any given enterprise. This raises the structural problem of being, by definition, a low-paid worker, which in turn ensures that the areas where women work are poorly paid. This circle can only be broken by the growth of militant trade unions for women, which would push the wage levels up to those of men. The problem of labor-intensive work, which is what most women's work is, can only be solved by the development of technology. Labor-intensive means that it's cheaper to hire, it's cheaper to hire, for instance, in an agricultural situation, 10 people to work in a field than it is to buy the equipment to do the equivalent work. That's what labor-intensive means. Capital-intensive means that it's more that there is a greater emphasis on the machinery which actually produces the stuff. That development of technology would change the nature of much of work and eliminate some of it. But capitalism has no incentive to develop technology in these areas. Clearly, a technology which can supersede the printer or the electrician with their high rates of pay may lead to increased profit. But why bother with work which is already done fairly cheaply by women unless women begin to demand equal pay for their labor? In 1970, women made up 71% of all people working in clerical occupations and 60% of all people working in service occupations. Only 17.5% of employed women were in professional and technical jobs. 76% of those women were in nursing and teaching. That is women's areas. Okay, then there are a bunch of statistics which I won't inflict on you, which essentially point out that no matter what area of life it is, even in the professions that in where women work doing comparable work to that of men, they get lower wages, and it's consistent across the board. It varies from something like 22% less wages to 39% less wages to 8% less wages, but it's consistently less. The point is clear. When women do work in the labor force, they work for less wages, thus allowing a higher profit for their employer than if the boss had to pay male wages. Why do we allow this to happen? First, because we have very little realized power. That is, women aren't yet conscious of what their collective strength can do. Second, because we do not expect to have to work in the workforce as a permanent condition of life. That is, our first expectation is still a family and someone to support us when we do the supportive things at home. I'm talking in mass terms, right? That's the general expectation in the society. Third, we consider any work we do as subsidiary income, necessary to keep the family above the poverty level, but still subsidiary. You get cases where union guys will drive, where this is taken such an extreme, that union guys will drive their wives across picket lines to take their wives to work, for instance, at Belltel and stuff like this. So, you know, even the other half of the labor movement doesn't consider it an important problem, women's work. Fourth, women are educated against receiving a technical skill and so aren't usually prepared or qualified to apply for craft jobs where there are higher wages. Fifth, women usually work in non-union conditions. 20.1% of women paid workers were in unions in 1968 compared to 39.7% of men. Because we see work as peripheral, these women work in non-union conditions because work is seen as peripheral, and often women are anti-union. It's unclear why. Also, the trade union movement has rarely attempted seriously to organize women, and that's pretty gross oversight. Women accept lower paid jobs, less satisfying jobs, the condition of being a sexual object as an office worker, a nurse, stewardess, waitress, because male supremacist ideology has convinced us that the real center of our lives occurs in the hours from 6 when you get home from work if you're not on night shift until 6:30 the next morning when you get ready to go back to work. In the hours with the family, women tend to expect that their real life will happen. This is a tendency among men also, but because women are socialized to expect even more emotional benefits from the family, that disappointment is even more severe. If there's a contradiction between illusion and reality, if work has drained us or the family is stultifying, the first reaction is still that it's our own fault. I know this amazing woman who raises 2 children by herself, works a 40-hour week, carries on life within the women's movement, and then kicks herself because she can't manage also to go to all the cultural events happening in the city. And that's a very common reaction, that somehow if one could just organize one's time well enough, everything would be possible, when in fact it's structurally loaded against women. The mechanisms to ensure that women continue doing double work and being profitable for capitalism are firmly entrenched in the economic structures of our society. And that's true of the family. There's an interesting distinction, which I just found out about, unfortunately, a couple of days ago, which is between the household and the family. Now, the assumption is that the family includes economic and sexual and reproductive functions. However, apparently, one can make a distinction, which is that the household becomes the economic arrangement of a given group of people. Could be an extended family, could be a communal situation. And the family consists of the sexual and children, reproduction. The reason that's useful to understand is because in a working class family, where the majority of women do work and have work, that means that the majority of power wielded by the male in the family is not so primarily economic as it is in the middle class family, where the woman is often completely dependent on the male for her support. So that working class women, in a sense, have an advantage in asserting their independence within the terms of the family because they're not economically bound in the same way. Juliet Mitchell, in her book, Woman's Estate, points out the role the family plays in reproduction. The family also fulfills another critical social need, that of training individuals to respond to authority. Without the early response of children to adults, first the father and then the mother, as authority figures, individuals would never internalize the need to go through massive harassment to be loved or accepted or successful. Women would en masse refuse current social organization. The family makes our consciousness about love and authority so nearly synonymous that we move from obedience to the father to obedience to the state with relative ease. That is, that if in your earliest learning there is a love and authority, loving someone and being in a subservient position to that person are seen as synonymous, that does very severe psychological damage, especially to women, because the highest authority in the family is the man. One of the most important ways we are conditioned to accept authority is through channeling of our sexuality. Wilhelm Reich, in his book, The Sexual Revolution, talks about how early channeling of sexuality into a forbidden area for the child makes that child more susceptible to authority. That is, passivity is closely bound up with a negative response to sexuality, so that there is a relationship between the passive, frigid woman and a response to authority. Okay, from the perspective, which is this, that women are defined in part because they are outside of commodity production, work within the home, and do unpaid labor in that situation. And the increasing fact that women are more involved in commodity production than previously, and that working class women have essentially been involved in commodity production from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Given those two major premises, I'd like to reconsider the problems that I talked about at the beginning of the paper. Capitalism needs individualized home labor, and individualized daycare in order to continue its present higher rate of exploitation of women. It also appreciates passive women who keep their husbands in line and out of trouble with authority. In a union town, there's the phenomenon known as the wife who says you shouldn't go out and strike, you should vote against the strike, because if you go out on strike, what are we going to live on? So it's women who are passive or frightened in that situation are useful, because they then make males in industry less aggressive. Women who have to spend their time worrying about scraping by with money or with lovers just in order to survive. I don't know of any examples of classes in power who are benefited by the existing arrangement of life who give up power. That is, they have an interest in maintaining their hold in power. While significant reforms can be won, women's liberation would appear to be impossible within the confines of capitalism because of that system's deep interest in having a section of the workforce which is doubly exploitable. The very core of capitalist production is wage slavery, out of which comes profit. And women in our present state are not only more susceptible to exploitation, we are also ideologically useful to capitalism through our acceptance and fostering of passivity, which begins in the family. Socialism can provide the basis for women's liberation by ending exploitation. That's the avowed aim of any socialist society, is that it ends exploitation. It also provides a basis for socialized childcare, socialized and industrialized housework, equal opportunity for education and for work, as well as the ability to plan conception without danger to women. Further, occupational roles for men and women can be broken down. Marx and Engels say in the German ideology, while in communist society where nobody has one exclusive sphere of activity, but each can become accomplished in any branch he wishes, society regulates the general production and thus makes it possible for me to do one thing today and another tomorrow, to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, just as I have a mind, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, shepherd, or critic. So that if you break down role definitions, that also includes breaking down sexual role definitions. Socialism can do so because its reason for existing is to do away with the profit motive as a method of organizing society and to replace it with a form of organization based on community of producers owning the means of production, thus dealing first with people's needs. It provides the basis for women to develop as full human beings without stereotyped roles through the ability to exert control over your own labor in your own life. Women's liberation has not been historically an inevitable consequence of socialism. In the Soviet Union, a society which went through the large part of industrialization as it was trying to develop a socialist society, daycare for all children did not become possible until fairly recently. Socialized and industrialized housework is still not a priority. That is, they've never investigated those problems very seriously. And the attempt made at changing the traditional Russian family made just after the revolution didn't succeed because of the strength and utility of the patriarchal family among a peasantry which was in the process of being industrialized. That is, that one of the major functions of the family is to provide a community. And in a society which is in gigantic social upheaval, the family becomes even more important because there's discontinuity of community in every other level. But the family is seen as the bedrock, and that's why I think there's so much fear about the breakdown of the family now, because it does provide the function of being a community. In China, where they've also been trying to reorganize society, women have played a full part in social production, but there have been, I think, historically inevitable almost, problems with repression of sexuality, which in turn leads to further problems within the society. So they're also, I don't think, well, I think they've probably come closer than anywhere else in the world to liberating women. I certainly don't think they've succeeded. Marx says in the Critique of the Gotha Program, with the abolition of class distinctions, all social and political inequality arising from them would disappear of itself. Okay, so but then how do you explain the fact that in the existing socialist societies that hasn't happened? Women aren't liberated in existing socialist societies. Why do we need a special women's movement to fight for our own interests? And there are some socialists who say, good heavens, you're wasting your time in the women's movement. You're achieving nothing. You should come out and fight for the revolution. And I think that's a rather abstract interpretation of how one does, in fact, struggle for massive social change, because it ignores the basis of people's struggles. People generally fight for their own self-interest out of pressures they feel in their own lives. It is when you realize that your own self-interest is a group, is similar to another group, there is a possibility of unity. The working class, one-third of which is women, does not carry within itself the possibility of changing society because it is morally better or superior, but because it operates and thus potentially controls the functioning of the modern means of production. As women, we have particular struggles which no one else will carry on for us. It is only as the women's movement develops and clarifies its needs that the possibility of working with other groups grows. In another passage from Critique of the Gotha Program, Marx deals with the problem of what is possible given material and historical reality in a way which is most salutary for those of us who tend to say, why aren't the socialist countries perfect? You know, if they've got socialism, how come we haven't solved all these problems long ago? And it seems to me that he provides theoretical reason for this when he talks about his discussion of equality guaranteed by the socialist revolution. He says this: equality consists in the fact that measurement is made with an equal standard, labor. That is, equality within a socialist society is based on the fact that people can all work. This equal right is an unequal right for unequal labor. In other words, these defects are inevitable in the first phase of communist society, as it is when it has just emerged after prolonged birth pangs from capitalist society. Right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and its cultural development conditioned thereby. Marx speaks of a period when equality can go beyond equality of labor to an era when people give to the society what they can and receive what they need. It is only in a period when the economy can provide plenty for everyone that all social and political inequalities will disappear. And it seems to me that that is the reason that you don't have women's in an absolutely liberated state in China, because they're still in the process of industrializing. Women are handicapped by assumption of labor in the workforce without the lessening of labor at home. So you're doing double work, except in a more aggrandized form. And it's at this point, given that reality, that the scientific and technological revolution becomes a critical factor. There's a book written by the Czech Academy, the finest minds in the Czech Academy, in 1966-67, called Civilization at the Crossroads, before the experiment in Czechoslovakia, which ended rather abruptly. And it was the blueprint for, or the attempted blueprint for developments within Czech society. And it deals with primarily the scientific and technological revolution. The Industrial Revolution transferred the creative elements of work from worker to machine, separated intellectual and physical labor, made the labor force mobile by making many jobs essentially the same. That is, if you're working in an office, typing in a lawyer's office, it's not qualitatively different from working in a stockbroker's office or in a newspaper office. You're doing the same kind of work. And you also are seen primarily as an extension of the typewriter. The typewriter isn't a tool that you use, but rather you're there because the typewriter's there, so that the whole basis of labor becomes changed. And people, instead of becoming the masters of the machine, in a sense become the extension of it. The implications of the scientific and technological revolution for women are tremendous. The possibility of breaking away from old forms of labor, the possibility of reintegrating labor in life. Further, with the development of technology, women will no longer be restricted to jobs which have traditionally been hers because of her supposed physical disabilities or social roles. Of course, Richter presupposes a socialist society where people's labor is non-alienated. He doesn't see this as a possibility. These developments as a possibility within capitalist society, because everything is motivated by profit. In Canada and other colonized countries, the implications of the scientific and technological revolution could be far different than in the socialist society. It could displace women from the labor force completely as work becomes scarcer in an economy which is primarily oriented towards resource extraction. We've already lost areas of technology which were developed previously. For instance, the electrical industry is all moving south of the border. We no longer build ships, although Vancouver was one of the largest places for shipbuilding during the Second World War, and in the machine tool industry, which just doesn't exist in the country. It is in our own interest, Canadian women, to struggle for an economy where secondary industry is developed and for a society where automation does not mean unemployment. The scientific and technological revolution has another importance for women. As definitions of work change and the study of human society and personality takes on more and more significance, skills which have been traditionally women's gain importance. The importance of understanding and changing human responses becomes central. That is, as Pope said in a different context, the proper study of mankind becomes man. That is, that will be a primary focus of our intelligence within the next century because of the scientific and technological revolution. And the size of your muscles is no longer qualitative for survival. It's how well you understand the society you live in. It is through this phenomenon that feminism becomes essential to the left. That is, just as I think the women's movement cannot develop or grow without some kind of Marxist understanding of the society we live in, seems to me that the left in general is equally hampered if they do not understand feminism for this very reason. No longer can socialists brush off too casually demands about quality of life, demands which are central to the women's movement because of our particular position of work and in the family. The economism the left has historically often fallen into becomes impossible. How can you talk about working women without talking about the family, daycare, and so on and so forth? That is, you can't just restrict your discussion to equal wages. I know, at least I think it's an impossibility, because if you do that, you deny whole areas of life which prevent women from working and keep them hampered. We need a women's movement which will struggle for women's liberation and for socialism. There are two major tendencies within the women's movement in Canada today. The first is the attempt to organize women around one issue. The second is to organize women into consciousness-raising groups with a resultant emphasis on changing lifestyles. Neither of these approaches to women's liberation seem adequate, although both have been very valuable. That's pretty clear. One-issue campaign organizing grew out of the attempt to create a mass awareness about one of the ways in which women are damaged by the state through lack of control over reproduction. The first demand was for free abortion on demand, then it was watered down to removing abortion from the criminal code. Obviously, it is a critical demand. That is the right to determine whether or not you will have children, you will reproduce. However, the campaign never dealt in any way with existing children. 24-hour-a-day free childcare with both parents getting time off work to help decide how it was operated would make an even larger change in more women's lives than abortion rights. It would liberate women to read, to talk to other women. It would free women to some extent from the tyranny of the home, and it would begin to make men equally responsible for care of children. That's a possibility. Both demands, each raising the problem of reproduction in the family, would have opened the way for a public analysis of the family, of women as unpaid labor, of women in the workforce, of sexual stereotypes about raising children. That is, the issues which are in fact key in most people's lives. That is, a public campaign around these two issues would have provided a much fuller picture of where women are and why than just the abortion campaign could do. If the daycare demand made any headway at all, it would mean we would reach many women the women's movement does not now see, who are locked at home with their babies or whose combined work and housework keeps them away. That there's a precedent, or there's a historical reason also to be leery of one-issue campaign work within the women's movement, and that's the what happened to women given women's suffrage. In the Seneca Falls Convention in New York, 1848, which was the beginning of the suffrage movement, essentially, on a worldwide basis, there were resolutions about complete equality in marriage, equal rights in property, wages, and the custody of children, the right to make contracts, to sue and be sued, to testify in court, and for the vote. However, as the women's movement developed, regardless of a large amount of internal struggle about what the focus of the women's movement should be, the succeeding tactic was the one-issue demand, that is, for the vote. Succeeded during the First World War, partly because the energies of large numbers of feminist women were channeled into the war effort. And that's one of the major reasons women got the vote. But the contradiction in that is that if the women's movement had instead dealt with all the other problems which it initially saw as important, there's a very good possibility that women in that mass way wouldn't have supported the war. Like, I'm not saying they could have prevented the war, but they at least wouldn't have supported it. The abortion issue took precedence in our own movement largely because it was a critical issue among student women, the women who initiated the contemporary women's movement, who were women without children and who often aspired to jobs as professionals. They were women who expected, although not consciously, of course, to avoid some of the flack of being women because of a slightly more privileged class position. That is, it's easier to be oppressed if you're doing a job which is relatively more satisfying and for which you get a relatively better wage than it is if you're a working class woman. The origins of the women's movement among students was also critical in determining the second major direction which the movement has taken, the move to raising consciousness and changing lifestyle. Among working women, both in the home and in the workforce, there isn't generally the time or possibility for 10 women to meet consistently enough to be practical. That, of course, does not say that it is not a good thing among women who have the possibility of meeting with other women. Their consciousness raising groups are very critically important because they change your perception. And coming out of that, out of women's realization about how they have been done in some essential ways, there's a tendency to put a lot of energy into changing your own lifestyle. Women are often caught in untenable situations. One of the central things which has emerged out of the women's movement is the right and need for women to live in communal situations, in gay relationships, in heterosexual situations without the strictures of monogamy, in single and multi-lover situations with and without children. That's one of the major things which has emerged in the past 6 years of women being organized in this country, that the right of people to live in many different ways. But there are two things about changing lifestyles which we need to examine more closely. The first is the question of the structures of capitalism which operate against those possibilities for the majority of people. And the second is whether or not that attempt should be the center of a women's movement. That is, changing individual lifestyles should be the center. Capitalism works against any structure but the nuclear family and city zoning laws, in the lower wage scale for women, in the lack of socialized childcare, in the propaganda for the nuclear family, in the marriage laws, in the difficulty for women in renting an apartment, getting a mortgage, in the physical structure of houses and apartment buildings. The majority of people are too used up in their work to expend more energy finding these solutions when everything works against them. Unless we change the structures which impede different lifestyles, these changes will be temporary. There is also the problem of working at the same kind of alienating work so that once more people really try to live outside of the workplace instead of attempting to integrate our lives by changing the nature of work as well as the hours of your life that you live outside of work. Which brings us to the central second point. Changing lifestyles is critical. Women need to live in patterns which create joy instead of pain, which must mean seeking out personal alternatives. The nature of women's oppression is such that for a while most women undergoing a process of rather dramatic change need to put most of their energy into finding out how they want to live individually. But the factors which work to create women's oppression in the first place also work to prevent or make difficult change lifestyles, particularly any kind of communal situation. Change lifestyles are a necessary but not sufficient condition for women's liberation. It's obviously hard to do anything if you're washing clothes, minding children, trying to go to school, etc., etc., etc. I mean, you're so burdened with work you can't do anything. But they're hard to achieve when they're impeded in so many material ways by the same drive for profit which supports male chauvinism in the first place. They cannot be achieved permanently on an individual basis. Another result of emphasis on individual change only is that some professional women tend to feel that as long as they are individually established, other women should be able to do the same thing. So that some professional women become consciously against the women's movement because they've made it and they don't see why other people shouldn't be able to. There's a third tendency within the women's movement, which has just surfaced within the last year, interestingly enough, largely in Vancouver.
school.
And that's an attempt to organize women through the workplace. The Working Women's Association, the attempt at organizing women on campus here last year, those kind of things are critical. Student women are also organizing. This course is an example of that. There's a course at the University of Alberta. There's another one at U of T. It's very important. This third approach, organizing around the workplace, combined with public campaigns about the issues of the family and reproduction, might be very productive. We also have to study ourselves and the society which made us. In brief, we need an independent women's movement which crosses class lines and includes many women's specific interests. If at some future point the left becomes coherent enough to permit a closer link, we have to be able to participate as a separate movement from a position of strength. The left within the women's movement must also be organized in terms of Marxist study groups, and I understand there's one operating with this course and another one operating in the city. And, okay, so that's how I think that the science of Marxism, the methodology of Marxism, can be useful to us in analyzing our position within the society and beginning to help us figure out what to do. There's, I'd like to read you a poem which is comes directly out of the political economy of British Columbia. That is, there are the towboats which take chips from sawmills to pulp mills. The sawmills and the pulp mills are not in the same place, and it's a major maritime industry in Vancouver. Large numbers of men work on the boats. They're away for 2 weeks at a time, at least. They work 6 hours on, 6 hours off, 6 hours on, 6 hours off for 2 weeks. And they're exhausted. With the result that the towboat industry has the highest divorce rate of any industry in the province. There are boats on which there are no men who have survived in their marriage relationships. Now this poem isn't about the poor man, it's about the poor woman who is at home. And the hysteria in it may be partly accounted for by the fact that in my own situation, the situation I found myself in, there was a man who lived beneath me who was in the habit of doing biting things like crawling up the stairs at 3 o'clock in the morning and breathing heavily outside the door. So that's one of the reasons for this. Towboat wife. You say even now my body stutters as it wanders toward sleep, but this is not the worst. When you are not here, when the boat is gone 2 weeks and the troll beneath screams records and stumps his cage until four, laughing, and I hide melons under the table and count them off, each day diminishing their number and your absence. When you return, the final one is withered, and I see my thighs grow fat white slugs and the bed is empty, my body stutters, and there is no sleep. And it's for those reasons that I think that an integration of socialism and feminism is essential for all of our survival. Thank you very much.